Back together again, you and I chatting it up on a very busy Thursday, March 12, 2026, on Connecticut Today. I wondered what the next few years could bring for the embattled Trumbull Mall, whose owners recently failed to keep up with payments on a $152 million loan used to buy the mall back in 2022. Connecticut Citizens Defense League President Holly Sullivan explained the latest gun bill that's being debated in Hartford. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso and former Republican State Senate Leader John McKinney got together to analyze this week's emotional public hearings at the state capitol. University of New Haven criminal justice lecturer, retired FBI agent Ken Gray analyzed breaking news concerning a synagogue attack in Michigan earlier in the day. And finally, we checked in with CBS News White House reporter Linda Kenyon on the latest regarding a possible release of oil from the nation's strategic petroleum reserve. You know, sometimes society has a tough time dealing with change, and we don't like to see the things that in particular become mile markers in our lives, right? Whether it's a TV show, a stage play, a tourist attraction, a great song. I heard a great rock and roll star once say that, hey, it's important for me to still go out and quote-unquote play the hits, because the hits are mile markers in people's lives. And not only is it artsy stuff like music and TV and sculptures and everything and great paintings, but it's the places we go. It's the places we congregate. It's the places that we have good memories of. And for a lot of us, my age, maybe even a little older and younger, whatever, the idea of the shopping mall became a big thing when, in the late 60s, early 70s, first it was outdoor malls. Remember at one time, I believe, and there's still pictures floating around out there, the Connecticut Post Mall in Milford was, at first, it was kind of this outdoor mall of individual groups of stores, and then it was enclosed, and now the enclosed mall is not really doing all that well. And now you see more and more mall properties. Now, some are still doing okay, I guess. But others are not. And the Trumbull Mall, and we've heard about this for the last several years, sadly, some of the news is not good when you hear about alleged criminal activity and criminal activity there that's been proven. Don't get mad at me for saying that. I'm just telling you what's in the news. We see and hear about that. And there's news now that the Trumbull Mall, according to this story, written a couple of days ago by Tanya Babar in Hearst, the Trumbull Mall is on the market. The owner has defaulted on a $152 million loan. Now, town officials in the town of Trumbull say they're hoping a buyer will see the property's potential for redevelopment. I'm hoping, too. Here's the thing, and without trying to be judgmental about jobs at any mall, I'm not going to sit here and be judgmental about, you know, whether or not, you know, what a property owner should do with his or her property, especially when they're forking over millions of dollars. But let's face it, they're not dead yet, but malls are dying, and that's okay. Society changes the way we work, the way we play, the way we seek pleasure in our lives, our leisure time, how we get from point A to point B, what we shop for, where we do that shopping, and how we shop. It's all woven into one here. Malls are dying. Now there are still some malls that do well. But you'd have to be kidding yourself if you think the traditional shopping mall, which in its heyday was great. And by and large, there are still malls that do a really good job out there. The Connecticut Post in Milford, nice and busy with the theater and the health clubs there and everything. But then again, there are malls whose business is down, and there are malls who have, let's face it, who have problems with crime, problems with perception of public safety. So what do you do now if you were to buy, and this is what we're going to start with today, assuming you've got a couple of $100 million burning a hole in your pocket. I mean, you've got money that is burning such a hole, it's scalding your leg. And somebody says to you, hey, for $152 million, you can take over the note or the financing or whatever is left on the Trumbull Mall. When was I there? Like last year or the year before? I had to get something, and I could only, and I ended up finding it. I'd have to remember what it was, to be honest with you. Now, I went in the middle of the day, and I parked as close to the door as I could. Hey, look, don't get mad at me. Now, yes, obviously, the majority of people, you know, shopping there are fine on the merchants, but listen, these malls have their problems when it comes to security, when it comes to the perception of them, but even let's factor all that out. What should any new owner of the Trumbull Mall or any mall per se, what's the future? Should it be? Now, we keep talking about a housing shortage here, affordable housing. Where can seniors live? How are we going to, you know, finagle all that? So the Trumbull Mall now was listed for sale. Went according through a process here, according to Hearst. Town officials say they're hoping a buyer will see the property's potential for redevelopment. I hope so, too. Now, what do you think should happen? And I'd love to hear from people who live in and about that area. Newmark, which is a global real estate company, is marketing the property, says here, as an investment opportunity. The economic and community development director in Trumbull says the property has been on the market for about 6 weeks, so it's been out there. Back in June, the Namdar Realty Group defaulted on a $152 million loan to the company used to buy the shopping center back in 2022. Says here the court-appointed receiver assigned Centennial Real Estate, the owner of the Connecticut Post Mall, to handle managing and leasing of the Trumbull Mall. So, okay, after the owner defaulted on the loan, it's being managed now by the Connecticut Post Mall. Centennial, no comment from them, according to Hearst. Namdar could not be reached. Officials say the town is excited about what a new investor could do for the property. I mean, to me, this is a no-brainer. If you're an investor, and this is nothing against the Trumbull Mall, this is nothing against any mall per se, any city or town, but come on, if you're an investor in the year 2026, and you're in a city or a state or a town like Connecticut and Trumbull, and you have a situation where all we hear about, right, is a dearth of affordable living, a dearth of affordable apartments, a dearth of affordable condos, why would you put retail back in there? Why would you do that? Are malls dead? Is anybody building a new shopping mall? Would anybody do that? And again, the concept was wonderful when it was new and shiny and something different. Everybody's got a nice mall story. We all do. Some have lousy mall stories. I had a really nice jacket stolen at a mall. I won't go into that. This was about 30 years ago. I'm well over it. Well, sort of. If that person tripped and hit their head on a curb, I wouldn't be all that bent out of shape about it, but I digress. It was just how it was stolen from me. Anyway, but I digress. But yes, that happened in a mall. Thank you very much. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Let's talk a little malls today to start off the show on a Thursday. What should the new owners, because there will eventually be new owners, I know it's in default. I know there's, you know, there says here in Hearst that the Connecticut Post Mall people are essentially running the Trumbull Mall people, which is good. Maybe they can squeeze a few more years of business out of it. But what should any new owners do with the Trumbull Mall and its property? Are malls dying? Are malls already dead? And it's just what to do with the corpse here. And again, I know there are malls that still do well. But are malls... Here's the way I look at it. It's a hockey thing. You don't go where the puck is. Like Wayne Gretzky said, you try and figure out where's the puck going to be in a few seconds and go there. So what should happen with the Trumbull Mall and that property and all those big parking lots and that big layout there? Look, how can you not make condos or apartments out of that whole thing? How do you not do that? Why would you even dream? Why would you even entertain the idea of putting retail back there? I know it's jobs, but come on. And for any mall, I don't know whatever happened to that plan in Milford where they were supposed to put apartments in the back of the Connecticut Post Mall? Remember where that Sears Auto Store is? Is it still there? I don't know. What happened to that? Well, I remember what the original pushback was on that, that it would maybe hurt the center of Milford. All right, whatever. But are malls dead? Because they sure are at least dying. And now there have been some mall conversions. I think part of Danbury is now apartments or going to be apartments. But what should new owners do? Because I guess somebody will eventually buy it outright. What should any new owners do with the Trumbull Mall and its property? That's a great piece of property there. Great access right off the parkway. Right, you know, in the Trumbull, Fairfield, Bridgeport Metro. Let's go. Let's do some housing there. Let's do some condos. Let's make it a luxury development or an affordable development. Why don't we do that? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC on a Thursday. On Connecticut Today, the website ccdl.us, the Connecticut Citizens Defense League. They are the top pro-Second Amendment organization in the state. We've talked to folks from the CCDL for years here, and I have all my previous talk stops here. There was a gun bill that was talked about yesterday, along with a homeschooling bill and a vaccination bill. And you may have heard the term and be a little flummoxed by it, especially if you're not a gun person. A lot of people are. A lot of people aren't. Glock switches, and you're like, you know, what is that, like an indie band? Hey, I'm going to see Glock switch tonight. No. Let's bring on our friend. We haven't had her here in a few years, actually. Holly Sullivan, who heads the CCDL. Holly, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. Great to have you back. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. How was it up at the Capitol yesterday? Before we get into the whole machinations of what this bill does and what they're saying could be modified and what can. What was the feeling up at the Capitol yesterday?
So it was a very busy day in the building, and it was interesting that they put so many conservative issues on one day. Got my thoughts on that. But I will say it was lovely to see the families and the kids. That's not something that we usually get to see on what's, quote, gun bill day. But I think the vibes were different in our room than perhaps they were in some of the other rooms. I think there was a lot of frustration in both rooms. I think in Judiciary Committee, a lot of us have been in that room many, many times before, and it was a really constructive conversation. And I don't know, I feel like some of the folks that were there for some of the other bills were having more struggles. I'll say that. Not that our issue is ever easy, but I think we've got a long, CCDL has been around for 17 years. We've got a long time rapport with the committee. So
yeah,
we kind of, you know, it was moving right along.
And I'm glad you do, Holly, because look, you guys and gals who belong to CCDL, and I know a few of your members, you're serious about their easy. You're serious people, and you do a great job, I think, at trying to educate. You know, most people, Holly, just say, oh, it's a gun. Well, it's a firearm, And if there's 1,000 different makes of cars with options, a lot of guns are like that too. Now, we have something here that I've had gun enthusiasts say, well, shouldn't really be an issue because there are already laws on the books against this. But let me let you get to that. We're hearing the term Glock switches, and we're hearing rhetoric about, well, this can turn a legal gun into a machine gun. So explain that in language, you know, my audience can understand here.
Yeah, so essentially Glock is perhaps the most popular make of firearm that uses what's called a cruciform trigger bar. It's just the way the internal mechanisms work. There's other brands that use it as well, but Glock is the most popular. And Glock is also one of the most popular pistols out in the market across the country. So obviously they're going to be the biggest target because they're the biggest market. So essentially, individuals starting way back in the 1980s manufactured a little add-on device to it that would make it fire automatically, meaning repeating fire. It's not how Glock intended it to be used. It is not the desire of the company that it be used that way. There's nothing nefarious behind it. What it is nefarious people that come up with aftermarket devices that are already illegal to use, right? So they are already banned. They can't become more illegal. They are already illegal. And, you know, it's not for a lack of effort. And I think that's one of the frustrating things is that the anti-Second Amendment lobby was really coming down on the manufacturer that this was their fault. And the manufacturers have tried numerous times to redesign their firearms. And, you know, especially in the age of 3D printing and people having access to technology that they didn't have years before, bad people do bad things, right? And they continue to work around the different efforts by the manufacturers to overcome this issue. But the reality is, you know, they're trying to, instead of dealing with the issue of criminals committing criminal activity, they want to just ban all the guns that this could possibly be used on, which is absurd because these are some of the most popular firearms in America. It's the most illogical thing that I have heard come out of Hartford in quite a while, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah, and Holly Sullivan is the guest from the Connecticut Citizens Defense League, CCDL. Holly, you're right. I mean, okay, 10, 15, 20 years ago, you could have nefarious people machining something or slipping somebody in cash saying, hey, cut this way, put a pinhole here, I'll give you $100. Nobody said anything. But as you said now, Holly, with 3D printing, with stuff available to the nefarious person in his or her basement, trying to stay ahead of this is virtually impossible. And what is the push here now? Are they trying to say in these bills, well, Glock knows this, so if they wanted to, they could go ahead and design it so this could never happen? But I think that's naive, isn't it?
I totally agree. I think it's completely naive. I think with enough ingenuity, I think you could probably make most firearms do things it's not intended to do. You know, you can make cars do things they're not intended to do. You can make baseball bats do things they're not intended to do. To simply ban one of the most popular firearms in the country is unconstitutional, right? And we, you know, that's a long time debate that's been going on in the rifle arena. And I think it's, you know, unfortunately not a good solution here. Yeah, but absolutely. Instead of saying, you know what, we're going to crack down on the criminals that get arrested with this. In fact, a question that was asked, Greg Howard, our representative Greg Howard, asked numerous times, what is the conviction rate of people that have been found with these? Crickets. They have no idea.
Really?
Are the people being prosecuted to the extent of the law? Nobody seems to know. But instead of dealing with that issue and coming in armed with those statistics and saying, here's where the problem is, they're saying, well, just ban all the guns that could possibly take this, which, you know, one of the silliest comments that I heard up there was, this isn't a ban on the gun, it's a prohibition on the sales. It's the same thing. My goodness, we're not stupid.
It's not a ban on the gun. Oh, man, Holly, before we let you go, okay, now, we know this happened yesterday. It is an election year. And you folks are very powerful, very influential. And Holly, this is a situation where even people who may be in the governor's party, I'm sure you know there are thousands of progressive and Democratic gun owners in the state, many of them looking at guns, as a lot of people do with other issues, as their ultimate, you know, expression of freedom. Hey, I'm not a Republican, but I'm a proud gun owner. So, you know, you got me on that way. So is this just a flex, Holly? Do you think from a political point of view, or are you hearing rumblings this could actually pass?
It could absolutely realistically pass. I am hoping that after our logical conversation about what this does to the actual residents of Connecticut, that we see some amendments in the language. But I think people should be aware that they should make no mistake. The end goal of the anti-Second Amendment lobby is gun control. They may come in and say that it's under the guise of gun safety, but we've been doing this a long time, and it is ultimately gun control at the end of the day and getting as many guns out of the market as they possibly can. And there are a lot of Democrats that do carry for self-defense. In our state, as you've been seeing, there are incidents that they need to.
Yeah.
Everyone has the right of self-defense. And there is a massive, well-funded movement to make it harder and harder to obtain a firearm.
All right, folks, get this information and more of the legislative angles, ccdl.us. That's ccdl.us, the Connecticut Citizens Defense League. Holly Sullivan. Hey, Holly, good to talk with you. We'll talk in a few weeks. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. We go from mall food to Chris Caruso. Chris, how are you, sir? Good afternoon.
Very good, Paul. Hey, Paul, before we begin, let me just, your last caller, I just want to correct something.
Okay.
Because the mall's next to Bridgeport,
all right.
Bridgeport has a lot of crime. There was a shooting a couple of months ago at the mall.
Yeah.
They weren't Bridgeport kids.
Okay.
So I just want to make it clear. It's easy to roll out your tongue. Well, it's Bridgeport, so there's crime. There's other issues with that mall that's been going on for a while. That has absolutely nothing to do with Bridgeport. Malls in general are not doing well financially. They're going under, and you got to find alternative uses. For example, Trumbull, right outside the mall, has all the rental housing that they built in order to subsidize the mall. So I just want to make that for the record.
Well, yeah, and Chris, before we get to Hartford here, so what do you think? Let me just ask you this before we segue up north.
Sure.
What do you think the best use for that would be right now? It's $152 million. The owner defaulted on it. It's a huge piece of land. It's a good location. What do you think the future of that is?
Well, I think it's a mixed use. One thing that we don't have enough of in Connecticut is elderly housing. And I think that would be great to have some elderly housing. You could have mixed use. You could put some retail in there as well. So I think it could be a mixed uses. But elderly housing would be very positive. Maybe that's an area. I know there's been a big dispute in Trumbull over a community center for the seniors because of the cost. Maybe that's a good spot to include that with elderly housing, some retail, some mixed uses.
All right. All right. Chris, listen, a lot of hot button issues up at the Capitol, homeschooling and gun laws as always. And who knows whether any of these bills are going to make it out of committee for a vote and go to the floor of the House or Senate. Because as you always said, they don't call a vote unless they think they can pass it. But another good example, though, of the people's voices, whether they were in person, Chris, or did it online. You know, the public comment thing is at least alive in Connecticut to some form.
Oh, it always has, Paul. And, you know, the public hearing is a great process for people to express their views. Unfortunately, I think it took on a political twist, not by so much the public coming up to speak, but frankly, the House and Senate Republicans turned it into a Republican agenda. And that's always sad because I know it's election year, and when I was up in Hartford, we never had that type of situation occur. But I also think there's going to be a very interesting election coming up this year, as a matter of fact. And I think people are jockeying for a position and getting their names out. And I think it's that silly time of the year. Unfortunately, the public is pulled into that, and it should never be. I was watching the hearing last night of public health, and there were members of the public threatening legislators, that if they don't vote the way they should, they're going to be thrown out at election time. And that was from a lot of the speakers.
Yeah.
There was a lot of misinformation about vaccines, and the commissioner spoke about it, made it very clear, under questioning by Republicans. And yet people got up and there were the talking points, and it was a lot of misinformation. And the other thing, there were three major issues in the same day.
Mm-hmm.
And partly that happens, Paul, because the committees have a very tight deadline in a three-month session. You know, there's deadlines when these committees have to move things out. And if you don't meet those deadlines, everything in the committee dies. So I think that's why everything was condensed. You know, some people argue it was political, but I think we got to look beyond that. I think the positive is, though, that the public was able to speak. You know, whether they agreed or with an issue or not, at least they got time to speak. You know, the one in public health, they voted at 12 midnight.
Yeah.
It would be ending the public hearing.
Yeah.
There's over 500 people on the list, Paul.
Oh.
And, you know, and they said, and the Republicans are, well, it should go on 24 hours. You know, there's legislators who live down county where we are, and they have to travel. We've had legislators over the year that have been killed while on the road because sleeping. We've had some that have, when we used to have the tolls, go into the toll booth, we had people that have physical disabilities as a result of it. So there's a lot of safety issues, too, that has to be considered. Now, to the credit of the chair people of that committee, they stayed till 1:30. Even though the hearing ended at midnight, they went and listened to other people to 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
So I think they were being responsive. But, you know, the sniping, frankly, by some legislators toward the majority party and, you know, constant election phrases, I don't think serves the public well. But all said and done, at least the public got to speak. And I think that's always good.
At any one time, Chris, we'll end on this. At any one time when you were watching that hearing, did you say to yourself, God, I miss this?
Oh, no, no. not yesterday, Paul. Again, I think it was, you know, what's unhappening. In some ways, Washington is coming to Connecticut.
Yeah.
And I've never seen the rancor before.
Yeah.
And the sniping at these meetings. Especially public hearings. And again, it's an election.
I get you.
You know, the Republicans lost 29 municipal leadership positions in the last election. So they're trying to make up for that. They're trying to get out there to be public. I get it. But I just thought it was the wrong place to turn this into a political agenda.
All right.
You know, but that's my view.
All right, Chris, thanks. Appreciate it. And we'll see you next Friday. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Take care, Paul.
Thanks, Chris. Chris Caruso there. So he's probably enjoyed watching that from the comfort of his home last night. All right, this gentleman, you see him as one of the panelists every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on the Capitol Report on News 8. John McKinney joins us. John, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul.
John, you were observing yesterday. I'm sure keeping an eye on what went on at the Capitol. Boy, big day, big bills. John, three big bills: one on vaccines, one on homeschooling, one on guns. I'm sure you had days like that at the Capitol. What are you thinking? And a lot of emotion, John, on this homeschooling bill. Let's start with that. And a lot of people don't realize, John, how few, and I was shocked when I looked into this, how few regulations Connecticut actually has on homeschooling.
Well, we do, but you know, the homeschooling issue has always been an emotional one.
Yeah.
And I think the frustration in this bill is that not only do they require families who choose to homeschool, they also require families who choose to send their kids to private school to every year put their name in, which is going to go get checked by the Department of Children and Families and get somehow approval to do what they believe is best for their child. The other part about the bill, Paul, which is scaring a lot of homeschool parents, is that they have to provide according to what the state will deem is an equivalent instruction to children in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're seeing a lot of homeschool parents who are really upset about that. And obviously, Paul, this is a reaction to a horrible death and murder of a young woman, Mimi Garcia Torres, from New Britain. And I think it's an overreaction. You know, that was not because the child was homeschooled. That was because the people who killed her were evil. And I don't think there was anything that could have stopped that, not even DCF, which does a wonderful job, an impossible task. They're never going to bat 1,000. So
yeah,
I think it's too much of an overreach here on the homeschool regulations. I personally would not be supporting this bill.
Yeah, and John, you know, I read the early draft of the bill, the PDF, and by about page three, my head started to hurt, but I stopped. But I did get far enough where it did get to that equivalent education part. And there was some, you probably read it, it was some innocuous language about mathematics, history, civics, whatever. And I just, maybe, John, I'm jaded because I've done this 40 years now. I said to my listeners, you can get mad about the registration thing with DCF, but what I said, and I think you just touched on, be careful about what they mandate for education. Because, John, as you say, part of the reason people homeschool is they just don't feel comfortable here in Connecticut or other states with being forced to have their children subjected to stuff that, all right, we may need to know about as functioning adults, but can we let kids be kids?
I think that's part of it, but, you know, and I have good friends who homeschooled their kids up until high school. They ended up going to private religious high schools, and they ended up going to Ivy League colleges. I didn't have the ability to homeschool my kids. I think it's an enormous task.
Oh, yeah.
And I really have a lot of respect for the parents who do it. And they are educating their children.
Yeah, absolutely. John McKinney is the guest from the Capitol Report on WTNH News 8 every Sunday morning at 10. John, your thoughts on the governor's race here? I think since last we spoke, there was that University of New Hampshire poll, which granted was not likely voters, it was registered voters, but I read through all the crosstabs and it's got the governor suddenly, for what it's worth, John, I know it's kind of early, at 49% here. And is that significant to you? Do you think his camp is looking at that? Are they trying to make a push to maybe appease more progressive voters here? What'd you make of that poll?
I don't make much of polls this time of year, to be honest with you.
All right.
You know, Dan Malloy, you know, I tried to run against Dan Malloy in 2014.
Yeah.
He was polling well under 50% approval ratings and still won his reelection. So I think it's way too early. You know, the governor might be looking at pushing some more progressive policies because he might be facing a primary from a progressive in his party.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in terms of overall polls, we're not going to really know anything until September.
Finally, John, on that, you know, and I've talked about this a lot, the goal, if you're Josh Elliott, you just want to get to a primary, just get out there and maybe pull a Zohran Mamdani, although I don't think you could do that. But, John, you know, stranger things have happened. Do you think that Mr. Elliott has a shot to get a qualification for a primary here?
I think he may get 15% from Democrats I'm talking to. I don't know that he's going to qualify for the public financing.
Okay.
And even if he does, because right now he's far off what he needs to do to get the qualification numbers. He needs about 350,000. He says he's at 150. Even if he does, I don't believe he's got a shot.
Okay.
I looked at those poll numbers similar to when I ran a primary against Tom Foley. I started out 40 to 50 points behind. It's an impossible task to make that up, and I don't think he'll do it.
But finally, you do think there's, from what you've heard from Democrats, you think there's a shot that he could get to that 15% level?
I think there is. I think there might be enough of a protest vote from the far left progressives. But you never know. At a convention, those 15% might say, you know what, I made my protest, but at the end of the day, I don't want to have the primary because I know Governor Lamont's going to win, and I don't want to weaken him against the Republican candidate.
Interesting. John, thanks. John McKinney, check him out this and every Sunday, 10 a.m. on News 8 with our buddy Tom Dudzik and the Capitol Report. John, good stuff as usual, and we'll talk to you next week.
Stop reading those bills for me, okay? Don't do that.
Why? John, I'm a single white guy at home in suburbia. What else am I going to do?
Well, you can spend your time turning the Trumbull Mall into a new courthouse and detention center. How about that?
Is that the official John McKinney pitch for this? Really?
No, John.
I got to tell you something. I have people sending me personal texts. There's just stuff I can't say. It's fall over funny about what to do with the mall, but let's just leave it at that, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. And joining us right now is a gentleman we like having on here, if only to be able to explain very complex and dire situations here when we have some sad news, as we do today. University of New Haven criminal justice lecturer and retired FBI agent Ken Gray as to what is going on in outside of Detroit. Ken, good afternoon. And I guess, Ken, if there's anything to be taken from this situation at this combination synagogue and school here, is that security worked, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, the good information that came out of this is that the security there at the Temple Israel in West Bloomfield, Michigan, was able to stop a person who rammed this car through the front door, exited his vehicle with a rifle, and was engaged by security right away. He did happen to hit one of the security guards with his vehicle, and that person has been taken to the hospital, but it looks like he will be okay. But security nonetheless engaged this shooter with gunfire and neutralized the threat. So the gunman is dead there in the synagogue. His vehicle had explosives in the back seat of the vehicle.
Yeah.
And it's not clear exactly what kind of explosives. There's a fire still going on inside the synagogue. And they're still in the process of clearing the synagogue to make sure, absolutely sure, there wasn't a second gunman involved. But nonetheless, they will have to put the fire out and then get the explosives out of the synagogue.
Yeah, and Ken, number one, before we go to the explosives thing here, and I saw one report unconfirmed where there were mortars, but having said that, going back to the security on this thing, Ken, you know, it is a sad thing in society, but if you're going to have security, Ken, and I'm not trying to be flip about this, if you're going to have security, it almost has to be armed, right? In this day and age, you can't just have guys and gals there with nice blue-colored shirts. They have to have some firepower, don't they? Especially in a situation like this.
Absolutely. So a person who is there tasked with providing security who is unarmed would be just another victim, because this person came with a rifle and explosives, and you're right, it's been described on one of the news networks as mortars, but he came with the intention of doing harm there, and he was armed, and because of that, a person who was there that was providing security that was not armed would not be providing any security whatsoever. They would just be another victim.
Yeah, and Ken, finally, not to get in the fire science of this, but when you have a vehicle or vehicles there that thankfully the perpetrator has now been, you know, permanently neutralized, we assume, you have these vehicles there or this vehicle that may have some explosives there, and I don't know how they do this, but they must be real careful because somebody's got to handle those explosives, Ken, or is there a way to, do you know whether there's a way to neutralize these things chemically, or do you put massive mats on them? What do they do here? Do we have any idea?
So normally with explosives, EOD personnel takes the explosives and puts it into a containment vessel and then detonates that explosive on site. But in this particular case, explosives are in the back seat of the vehicle that was rammed through the front of the synagogue.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a delicate operation to get the explosives out of the car, out of the synagogue, and neutralize. So it's going to take some EOD personnel that has some experience doing this to be able to handle that situation. But in the meantime, the synagogue has big billowing black smoke coming out from every possible exit. And so they're going to also have to deal with that fire, and they're going to have to deal with that fire before they can deal with the explosives.
And Ken, finally, in your experience with the Bureau, I'm sure the FBI has got nationwide alerts out right now with personnel probably eyeing several possible targets along with local police in those areas.
So especially considering the fact that there was also an incident in Norway at a synagogue. The fact that there was an incident in Norway and an incident here in Michigan at the largest synagogue in the United States, to me that means that this may be connected to the ongoing conflict there with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's necessarily somebody connected to Iran, but somebody that somebody or somebodies who are responding to that as kind of a lone wolf type action. That's a possibility, but it doesn't discount the fact that it could be somebody that is just anti-Semitic that's carried out an act on their own.
All right. Retired FBI agent, senior criminal justice lecturer, University of New Haven, Ken Gray. Ken, as always, we thank you for your expertise, and I'm sure we'll be checking in down the road. Thank you, Ken.
Anytime.
All right. Ken Gray, University of New Haven, longtime retired FBI agent and senior criminal justice lecturer there. All right. Speaking of CBS News, one of the great folks we like to check in with in D.C., Linda Kenyon at the White House. Linda, good afternoon, and how are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you, Paul. It's good to be here.
And oil now. All eyes are on oil prices. I'm watching the live ticker in front of me, Linda. It literally is moving like a slot machine. I mean, literally tickling $100 a barrel. Now, there's pressure, right, on the White House here. What is the White House saying about releasing or going into or tapping some of those oil reserves? What's up with that?
Well, you know, the president has been very proud of oil prices going down, and now he refers to the price hikes amid the war against Iran as, in his words, a short-term excursion. So this excursion, if you will, has led to an action by the Trump administration to ask for the release of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to drive down prices. And that would be in conjunction with other members of the International Energy Agency, which is made up of dozens of countries, to release what is being considered the largest volume of emergency oil reserves in the IEA's history. So this is all as a result of those rising oil prices because of the war against Iran.
Finally, Linda, is there any indication, I mean, you said he's asking, is there any indication when there might be a yes or a no on this, or do other people have to be consulted? How does this work?
Well, Energy Secretary Chris Wright did say yesterday that the drawdown is always ready to go, the drawdown from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and that he will release 172 million barrels. And that, however, that doesn't mean it's all going to happen in one day. In fact, it could take about 13 days for it to take effect in the marketplace and about 120 days to complete the release of an estimated 172 million barrels.
All right. Linda Kenyon, CBS News. As always, Linda, thank you. Have a great weekend, and we'll chat down the road. Thanks, Linda.
Sounds good.
Appreciate it. There you go. Linda Kenyon, CBS News.